Hey, welcome to the Caving Podcast. Before we get started, El Spilio is one of our fine sponsors. And right now, one of their most popular lights, the Terra, is $50 off. Get a Terra and save $50. Or if you want one of their other great lights, you can save $20 off all regularly priced headlamps with the promo code PODCAST. Go to elspilio.com and get a Terra for $50 off, or any other headlamp, save $20 with the promo code PODCAST. Or if you don't get a headlamp from them, they sell other stuff too. You'll save $20 with that promo code PODCAST as long as you spend $300 or more. Again, elspilio.com. I cannot recommend the Terra highly enough. Invest in a great light. You will not regret it. Get a Terra from elspilio.com and save $50 right now. This is the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. And this is a podcast about caving. What is caving? If you're here for the first time, welcome. If you're interested in cave exploration, great. This is the place to be. We'll talk about it, but what this is it's a podcast where I talk to cavers. So primarily cavers are the one listening. But if you're here and you're curious about caving, that's great too. You'll hear from some of the best cavers in the world, myself not included. I'm kind of a recreational caver, but you can be too. And most people who get serious about it start as recreational cavers. They go on a few fun trips. Some of them stick to fun trips, like me. They will get into it for other reasons. Who knows? But if you're interested, great. Find your local grotto. How do you do that? Well, you go to the NSS website. What's the NSS? The National Speleological Society. And a grotto, what is that? That's like a local chapter. It's just our word for a local chapter. And you can find it at the NSS website, and it's a very easy website to remember, caves.org. How about that? Caves.org. And there you can find your local grotto, get in touch with the leadership, find out when they're going on trips. Not a lot of trips going on right now because of the pandemic, but you may end up getting hooked up with some people who have been socially distancing and who have been quarantining and who have been, you know, doing all of that and want to get out. And as long as you can promise to them that you've been doing the same, maybe they'll take you along. So again, go to the NSS website, caves.org, get in touch with your local grotto, get in touch with their leadership, and they can point you in the right direction. Every grotto's got a few people that are great with beginners, and your grotto is probably no exception. So do that. And also, caving is dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, but quite the opposite if you do. And we have some rules, some protocols that you need to follow. Wear a helmet, 3 sources of light, go with at least 2 other people, you know, groups of 3. That's kind of the minimum. Never go alone. There are other rules too. You should find them out. Again, get in touch with your local grotto. No caving for me in the last month. I'm a little busy with my 2 small children, Sully, my youngest, Sullivan, not named after the cave. Again, I have to say that every time, but in my heart, he's kind of named after the cave. Indiana, there's a great cave called Sullivan Cave. He was born about a year ago. I'll be celebrating his first birthday, on next month's episode. August 3rd of 2019 is when he was born. My son Finn, he's 3. And so they keep me pretty busy. So I've not been caving. However, my in-laws and myself and the family, we went down to Red River Gorge for the annual family vacation last week. Red River Gorge in Kentucky. It was great. It was a fantastic time. And I ran into someone down there randomly who had heard the podcast. I was wearing my Indiana Cave Capers shirt on a hike, and I ran into them. And I am so sorry. They're from Indiana, from Yorktown, Indiana. I am so sorry if you are listening, if you are the person I ran into. I did not ask your name, but we had a great little conversation on the trail. He said he loved the podcast and had heard it and had been to Indiana Cave Capers. And it was just really crazy to run into somebody who had heard it. That was cool. I mean, I guess if I was going to run into anybody who had heard it, that would be the place to go. Red River Gorge is wonderful if you've never been. And a shout out to Dean Wiseman, who I've had on the podcast before. My very first rappelling trip was at Red River Gorge, and he took me, and I went back to that spot to show my sisters-in-law some rappelling, and I brought the gear and I brought some rope, and we had trouble finding the spot. Gosh, I felt so embarrassed because I'm like, ah, this is a great spot. We're going to go do it. And then I couldn't find it. He helped us out. He helped us find it. I texted him and he got back with me and we ended up finding it. But had we not dilly-dallied trying to find it, I wouldn't have run into that guy because I was on the same hike. So maybe it was serendipitous. But anyway, it was a great time. Pat Cambyses is this month's guest. Pat Cambyses, she has been on my list of dream guests for this podcast since the very beginning. And I mentioned that twice in the interview. I'm sorry in advance. I say it at the top. I say it at the end. But it is true, and it is worth repeating. She is a pardon my language. She's a badass. She's a badass. She was on the crew that discovered the Chandelier Ballroom. In fact, she was in Lechuguilla. She was the first person to see the chandeliers in the Chandelier Ballroom. I mean, are you kidding me? If you've seen the Planet Earth Caves episode, it's the cave at the very end of that episode. And they've got a great shot of the Chandelier Ballroom. Go back and watch it. Anyway, she discovered that room. How awesome. And, you know, that is one little highlight of her entire decades-long caving career. And we talk about a lot of it, not nearly all of it, in the just over an hour that we're going to spend together. So I look forward to you hearing Pat and I talk in just a minute or two. Of course, the NSS Virtual Convention is July 27th through the 31st. I will not be able to attend, again, busy with children, busy with job, but, if you can, I would encourage it. And, you know what? And here's another thing. Organizations, local organizations, grottos, you know, cave conservation, groups are, we're all hurting right now for a lot of reasons. I mean, the pandemic, of course. If you have it in your pocketbook to make a donation to the organizations that you care about, I would highly encourage you to do that. I'm going to do the same. I'm going to donate to the Indiana Karst Conservancy. I'm going to donate to my grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto. And I'm saying that on the podcast so that I will do it. And I promise you that I will. And I would encourage you to do the same. Make a donation to your grotto, make a donation to the cave conservation, organization that you care about. Cause they need it right now. Yeah, I guess if you're looking for suggestions, you know, think about grottos that put on big events like Speleofest put on by the Louisville Grotto. They had to cancel because of the pandemic. Karstorama by the Greater Cincinnati Grotto, they canceled as well. These are usually the biggest fundraising events for those grottos of the year. And to cancel them means they lose a lot from their annual budget. And they can't do the things that they would normally do. Like, for instance, our grotto, we like to sponsor exploration with some of the money that we make. And we're not going to be able to do that if we end up canceling Indiana Cave Capers. And by the way, Indiana Cave Capers is still on. We're trying to decide by the end of this month, July, whether or not we have it, that second weekend in August. By all accounts, the numbers may not look great by then, in Indiana. It's not really being contained, the way it should be. And there are a lot of reasons behind that. Some of them are political, and so I won't get into them, but, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, make donations to your grotto, those grottos, whatever you'd like. I would just encourage that. The other bad news that we just got a couple days ago, OTR, Old Timers Reunion, was canceled for this year. I think it was the right call. Unfortunate though. Highly unfortunate. This year sucks, but I'm glad that I'm still able to do this podcast. I'm glad you're here listening to it. All right. Congratulations to the new directors of the NSS from the election that was held last month. Sonia Meyer from California, Pete Johnson from Colorado, Benjamin Tobin from Kentucky, Riley Drake from Massachusetts, Nick Anderson from South Dakota. Hey, guys, all five of you, I would love to have you on the podcast. All right, reach out. I'm serious. And if you don't, I will. I'll find you in the directory, okay? But if you want to be on, I would love to have you on. I love these new directors. They're young. They're active. And I adore this crew. I think it's fantastic that these are the people who are going to be doing the work. So congratulations to you. And if you are one of those five people and you're listening right now, my email address is alpineproductions@gmail.com. alpineproductions@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. All right. So sorry that this intro has gone so long, but thanks for sticking through it. Pat Kimbesis, I can't say enough good things. I'm just so happy that I got to talk to her. And we talked about a lot, as you'll hear. Here we go. You are among my dream guests. I will just say that. And I'm not trying to butter you up. Right, well, I'm trying to butter you up a little bit. But you've been on the list since the beginning. You were mentioned in the very first episode by Ron Adams. We've talked about you before with other guests. Everyone's like, you got to get Pat. And now I got you. So welcome.
So why don't I tell you, since Ron, I don't know what Ron said about me, but I've done some caving with Ron. And it was when I was living in Tag. I lived in Tag for like about 10 years. And so, you know, I've been a cave mapper for most of my caving life, not all of it, a small part of it not, but most of it, yes. And when I moved to Tag, I was looking for things to do. And it's not hard to find caves to map in Tag, right? There's what? Well over 10,000 caves, probably only a third of them are mapped. So to me, it was like, that was pretty awesome because there's lots of stuff to do. And what I decided I wanted to work on were the multi-drops of Tag. And so I picked a couple multi-drops, and a couple of them were pretty serious caves. And I don't even know how I connected with those guys. But I figured that the people that would help make it happen would be some Indiana cavers. And I knew Danny, and I knew Ron, and there's a whole host of others. Greg McNamara, knew a bunch of those guys, and asked them if they would be interested in mapping. Our first project together was called Hickey Pot, which is a deep multi-drop in Tennessee. And just as with any multi-drop, it starts out pretty nice, but eventually it degrades into some nasty, long, long crawlway in water. And basically, if it wasn't for those guys, I don't know that we would have ever finished that cave. They were just amazing. And you know, we're talking about flat out belly crawls, you know, with you can barely sight over the compass. And they were like the dream team. Like, you knew that if Ron and Danny and whoever was with them, Joe Oliphant, that they were going to come back with the goods. And they did. And we did a couple other projects, too. And so I've always been in awe of those guys because there's like nothing that phases them. As a matter of fact, where you think the cave doesn't go anymore, they think it does. And so that's their whole attitude. So anyway, so I love caving with those guys. They've always been awesome.
Have you been caving in Indiana?
A little bit. I haven't done a lot of caving in Indiana. Just... And I don't even remember what I did, but not a lot. There are so many caves. It's just ridiculous.
Well, and you can't
possibly go everywhere.
And when you're down there in the thick of it, you're down there in Kentucky. And so there's no shortage of things to do right around where you're at. And like when you lived in Tag, where did you spend most of your time? You mentioned Tennessee.
Well, I did most of my caving in northeastern Alabama. Just because there's lots of nice multi-drops there. But I did venture up into Middle Tennessee to like Blue Spring Cave. Hickey Pot was one of the ones that it was a deep multi-drop in Tennessee that I wanted to hit that nobody else had mapped. And so I basically made a list of what hasn't been mapped. And then I just basically worked on that for about 10 years. And like I said, most of it, a little bit in Georgia, not that much, but mostly in Alabama. I love Alabama.
Okay, so what is it about Alabama that you like so much? I mean, other than the obvious, I've been caving there myself, and I can't wait to go back.
Oh, it doesn't have much of a Hartzell. In other words, the Hartzell, it's a geologic formation. And when you don't have a lot of Hartzell, then you tend to have like really big pits, really deep pits. Like, so Alabama has a lot of nice multi-drops. It has a lot of, it has a couple of really tall domes that people are working on these days. And it's because it's missing this layer, which is usually an obstacle in Tennessee.
It's like an impermeable layer of rock where not much happens past it.
Well, what happens is everything flows on top of it until it hits a crack. And then it goes down into the Monteagle. So that's sort of the formula for multi-drops and tag, is that if you come in on the Pennington, which is like, you know, is almost as high as you could go for good cave development, then if you're going to make it to the Hartzell, you know, and Hartzell is usually some long ass nasty crawlway with water and cobbles and God knows what else. And if you make it past that, then you could be on your way to making a nice 500-foot deep cave.
So, you know, I mean, even hardcore cavers like yourself, they speak of long, nasty crawlways in those sort of negative terms. But, I mean, there is something about that, if you're doing it, that kind of, I don't know, shows you what you're made of. But you've done enough of it probably to where, you know, if you come across it, it's like, well, I got to do this, but I don't have to like it.
True.
Yeah.
And usually the trip gets better after, as time goes by. So you know how that goes. When you're in there, it's pretty miserable and you're like, oh my God, do I ever want to do this again? But what non-cavers don't understand is that you're never just going in there randomly. Okay. You always have a goal. Like if there's wind blowing in your face, it doesn't matter how nasty it is. You're going to push it, right? Because there's wind blowing in your face. If it has potential, you're going to go for it. And that's why people push these long, nasty crawls, not because we like them. Although I think the Indiana cavers do like them.
There are a few. Yeah.
But you know, in general, you know, it's, you're miserable when you're there, and then when the trip is over, you know, you forget. As a matter of fact, it's caver amnesia, right? You probably know what that is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Where you forget all the obstacles as you pass them, and you forget them on the way out, and then you're like, oh, I'm ready to go back.
So I want to get to the beginning with you, although it's, I don't know, you've been at it so long and you've done so much, but I still think it's worth talking about your genesis. Like, what got you started? where was the first cave?
Okay, so my first, as you know, real cave, I guess I could say, was in Missouri. And I didn't, my first cave trip was not like, oh, well, you know, I love caving, I want to go caving. It was because a person that I was with was a caver. Like my significant other was a caver. And he always said, well, you know, I will never give up caving. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. Well, I'd like to try it once just to see, you know, what is it about it that you really like? And so I went on my first caving trip in Perry County, Missouri, in a cave called Mystery Cave. And I was expecting to see this. It's one of the longest caves in Missouri. It's like a 14 or 15 mile long cave system. And I was expecting some big entrance, right? But no. So we went out like in, I don't know, early January, where it was freezing cold out, and we're walking out in this cow field, and there was this smoking hole, and I'm like, what the heck is that? And they're like, that's the cave entrance. Like, oh, okay. And so, of course, once I went and stood over it, that air was like 55 degrees, and it was zero outside. So I'm already very positive about the caving experience, right, because I'm going to be warm. But anyway, once I got down this little squeezy down climb and popped into this big cave, it was like at that second is when I became addicted to caving. Because I don't even know how to explain it. It was kind of like, wow, I feel like I should be here. And you know, I spent like 6 hours running around underground with these two guys, and they showed me a lot of cool places, and I was just hooked from that. And so I went from, yeah, caves to, oh my God, I'm possessed with caves.
Well, after that, though, I mean, if you were addicted from the moment the warm air hit you, then and then you went through 6 hours of caving wonder, then when was the next trip after that? Do you recall?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Because so I had just joined the Little Egypt Student Grotto in Southern Illinois. And one of the grotto members was named Philip Moss. And Philip doesn't cave anymore, but at one time he was very much into caves. And he had been caving he's like 5 years younger than me, but he'd been caving, you know, since he was like, I don't know, not an infant, of course, but he'd been caving longer than me. And he decided that, you know, taking me to Mystery Cave where it was big, beautiful passage, you know, that's not really the test of if you're really going to be a caver. So he decided he was going to take me to some nasty ass little crawly cave in Illinois, which he did. I think it was called Cobb Cave. And it was a pretty nasty chert and gravel crawlway. It was muddy, it was wet, it was nasty. And I guess his idea was that when I came out of there, I'd hate caving. And I don't know if that's really what his idea is. But anyway, that did not discourage me. So
in the least, did it though? I mean, was there any part of you that was like, ah, okay, if this is how it can be, obviously you've overcome it. But I mean, at the time, do you recall how you felt about that?
Yeah, I'm like, I know there's better than this.
Because I've been there.
I've seen it. So this is just an aberration. You know, of course there's better than this. But at that time, I was not a cave mapper yet. So when I first started caving, I could give two flips about cave mapping. I thought it was boring, and I didn't really want to do it. I'd been on a couple of cave mapping trips, and I was just like, what a waste of time. And so for the first maybe 6 months of being a caver, you know, I was like, you know, I was more like a scooper, or let's just go explore the cave and forget about all that that survey stuff. Until I actually got to be on my first scoop, one of my very few scoops. And it was in another cave in Missouri, very close to the cave that I mentioned, Mystery Cave. And this was a cave called Rimstone. And my dream had always been to connect these two caves. You know, one of them is like a 15-mile one. The other one's like a 14-mile one. And so there was a lead in Rimstone River that was like a low crawly thing. And I'm like, oh, I could go through that. I've been through low crawly things. And so I went with another person, with another caver. And sure enough, we got through the crawl and we got into Virgin Cave and we went for, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours. And the cave, you know, just kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And finally we're in this belly crawl and we can't really tell if we're connecting to anything. We just know that it keeps going. And because there was a threat of rain that day, and you don't go caving, by the way, in Perry County, Missouri, if there's more than a 30% chance of rain. We came out and I was all excited about, you know, this passage that was going, you know, toward the cave to the connection of my dreams. And so a couple of weeks later, I was in Kentucky and one of the guys who was the explorer for one of those, for that cave, that in that guy is named Don Coons. I told him, oh my God, I went to Rimstone and got into this great lead and think it's going to connect to Mystery Cave. And he's like, that's great. He says, how far did you go? And I'm like, I don't know. He says, well, what directions were you going in? And I'm like, I don't know. He says, well, like, what was the cave like? And I'm like, I don't remember. And he was like, so unimpressed. And I was just so completely deflated. And I was like, oh. And that was kind of what made me see the value of mapping caves.
So what, I mean, in retrospect, were you anywhere near? I mean, in knowing the part of the cave that you were in, perhaps was were any of your, I guess, feelings about it correct?
No, I mean, it was, you know, people went back later and surveyed it, and it certainly headed toward the target cave, but it was never connected. Well, so to this day, those two cave systems are not connected.
All right, so We started at the beginning. We're moving our way toward actual surveying and mapping and things like that. So you got this appreciation for that, and then you start doing it. What did you start with?
Well, I and keep in mind that during all this time that's happening, I've been moving to different places, right? So I was in Southern Illinois, and then I was in Kentucky for a while, and then I ended up in Northern Illinois. And I was part of a grotto there who was looking for a cave project, and they were the Rock River Speleological Society. I think that's what their name was. And they had hooked up with some cavers from Iowa, I think. I'm pretty sure. And anyway, these Iowa cavers knew of this big, bad cave in northeastern Iowa that, you know, was open for people to participate in, you know, continuing the survey of it. And that cave is called Coldwater Cave, which is the longest cave in Iowa. And granted, Iowa doesn't have a lot of long caves. And ultimately, this guy is like, I don't know, 17 miles long, I think. But at the time, it wasn't. It was only like 7 miles long. And so the grotto decided to take surveying in Coldwater Cave on as a survey project. And so, of course, I was all excited to be part of the survey teams. And I typically started out, you know, being either the lead tape person or the instrument person. Didn't start out as a sketcher. And pretty much the deal was, is if you didn't have a sketcher, you didn't have a trip, because the whole point was to try to be productive. And let me also mention about Coldwater is that it's in northeastern Iowa. So it's about 45 degrees temperature in there. So it's friggin' cold, at least for me anyway. And so it was pretty like serious wetsuit caving and crawlways and not so crawlways. And so I really got involved and excited about that project. And one of the trips that we went on, we didn't have a sketcher. We used to pile into somebody's van, drive up. It was a 5-hour drive to Decorah, Iowa. We were camped up there by the cave, went off to have breakfast, and we didn't have a sketcher. We're like, well, dang, what are we going to do? You know, we drove all this way. We're all here. We're all ready to go. And so the guy who is our project coordinator, and his name was Pete DeVries, he said, well, whoever can sketch the restaurant the best gets to be the sketcher. And so my sketch of the restaurant won, and that was how I started out being a sketcher.
Well, there we go. I never would have guessed Iowa.
Iowa. Yeah, that's what my advisor said years later when I decided I wanted to go to graduate school. And at the time, he's like, man, you can go anywhere you want in the world to do your cave research. He says, where are you going to go? And I said, I want to go to Iowa. And I could just like hear his jaw drop. And he's like, Iowa, why the heck do you want to go there? Why not China or, you know, or who knows, any place but Iowa? And I was like, well, I already have a project there and I could get to Iowa every weekend, whereas I can't go to China every weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
But so anyway, so I did a lot for about 3 years. I just, you know, we get a once a month project and we were pretty much dedicated and we went once a month, every month. I still think that they still go once a month, every month to Coldwater Cave.
Where'd you go after Iowa?
Well, I went back to Southern Illinois and actually got a degree in geology because of caving. I felt like the best way to understand caves is to understand the geology. And I didn't know jack about geology, so I went and got a geology degree.
Yeah, so, you were that serious about it.
Well, yeah. Yes, as a matter of fact.
I mean, who am I talking to?
But so after I got my, and I caved in Southern Illinois and in Missouri and various other places while I was, you know, getting my geology degree. But then since I was in geology, the geology jobs, if you wanted to be a geologist, were in the oil and gas industry, which means you had to go west.
Right.
So I went to Colorado. And just a bunch of my classmates moved to Colorado to look for geology jobs. And so we all kind of like room together while we were looking for jobs, and we all eventually got jobs. And so, but that's how I ended up out west. And of course, I didn't know any cavers in Colorado. Like all the people that I was hanging with, they were not cavers. They were just, you know, my random geology classmates. And so, of course, what do you do when you go to a place where you don't know any cavers? What do? You got your NSS directory, right?
Right.
So I pulled that thing out and like looked up Colorado and just randomly picked a name. I picked, oh, Jerry Forney, that looks like a good name. So I called this guy up out of the blue and I said, hi, I just moved here and I don't know anybody. And, you know, I'm kind of interested in, you know, getting involved maybe with the grotto. And he's like, oh, we have a grotto meeting this week. I will come and pick you up.
So
he came and picked me up and took me to that my first Colorado grotto meeting, which was pretty cool. And so I was a Colorado caver for like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years or something like that. And so that's kind of how I ended up there. And of course, I ended up working for Jerry. I, you know, did a bunch of house sitting for him. He has, and I don't know if he still has it, one of the most fantastic cave book collections that I've ever seen anywhere in the universe. But anyway, so that's how I got involved with caving in the West, which is very different than caving in the East. At least at that time it was. And that was before the Lechuga breakthrough. So we're kind of like moving along, you know, in years here.
So does the Colorado, do those years bridge into the Lechuga time then? Because it was discovered by Colorado cavers.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Lechuga had been known for you know, much longer than cavers knew it because it was an old guano mine.
Yeah.
And cavers had been digging on that thing for maybe 20 years. And the thing about it is that, you know, it was just another one-room cave in the Quads. But the thing about that cave that was notable is this big talus pile, this big breakdown pile at the bottom, almost to the bottom of the pit, that had air that came out of it that sounded like there was a freight train that underneath it, seriously. And so, I mean, you know, and occasionally the wind would come out of there so strong that it would blow dust out of the pit. So people suspected that there might be something there. And ultimately some Colorado cavers, a guy named Dave Allured, who is a hardcore digger, got a permit from the national park to dig in Lech. And I guess they figured, and at the time, we weren't calling it Lech. I forgot what we were calling it. Or maybe we were. I don't know. Whatever. It doesn't matter. So I'm sure that they were like, yeah, a bunch of other crazy cavers want to dig in this hole. Sure, we'll give them a permit. And of course, nobody expected. I mean, you can always hope that the cave would go, but, you know, you never really know. And so I got like, after they did like 4 digs over the course of a couple of years. And I think it was in 1986 that they finally like broke through into something. And I got involved just like shortly after that, like where we were in there surveying Virgin Cave in the Quads. And at the time it was, nobody suspected what we had gotten into. There was like no clue. We just knew that we had going cave and that there was a lot of air in really big passage. So there must be some cave there, but how much we never really guessed.
But I mean, could you tell right away, as soon as you got in? I mean, I've never been there. I probably will never end up there, but could you tell that it was something special right away? Or did it look alike there at the beginning, just after, you know, the dig point, did it look a lot like a lot of the other stuff in the Quads?
Well, it kind of looked like other Quads caves in the beginning, which, by the way, let me back up here a little bit. So about the time that this whole Lech breakthrough happened, I moved from Colorado to Texas.
All right.
Don't ask why. That's, I just did.
Tracking you across the country.
Yeah. So here I am in my odyssey across the country. And I lived in West Texas. And of course, had, you know, been doing a bunch of caving in the Guads because, well, Guads caving is really cool. And so the first part of Lech looks like other Guads caves. You know, it's got an entrance drop. There's other vertical caves in the Guads. And it wasn't until you got to the first major drop that you realized that this doesn't exactly look like other Guads caves. And that was to a place called Boulder Falls, which basically you run down this pretty mostly horizontal passage, a few little, you know, not really rope drops, but, you know, handline kind of down climbs. And you come to this big hole in the ground. It's like, whoa, big black hole in the ground. And that's where we started to think that, oh, maybe this is not your typical Guads cave. And once you got to the bottom of Boulder Falls, which was a 140-foot pit, do you ever have your dream cave before you knew any better? You're like, man, wouldn't it be cool to find a cave that just kept going and going and going? And that's what it was like.
Oh, man.
It was like, oh, my God. You know, every time you went in there, it was something new. It was just friggin' amazing.
You were right at the beginning. I mean, you weren't like at the breakthrough dig or anything. Were you on any of the dig trips?
I did not go on any of the dig trips because I was moving at the time.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And so, but I was scheduled to be on like one of the following trips, and it just happened to be after they made the big breakthrough.
Oh,
and
man.
So it was like, yeah, it was pretty amazing. I don't know how else to describe it. But one thing I can say after seeing a bunch of Guads, a bunch of Lechuguilla cave, is that there's a little bit of Lechuguilla in all of the caves in the Guads. It's just that we didn't know that at the time. And what I mean by that is, like, there are certain areas in Lech where you have this big, like, powdery, rock, flowery stuff on the floor. And it's like, what the heck is this? We've never seen this before. Well, when you think about it, we have seen it before in other Guads caves, but the caves have been trampled so much that we trampled it down and didn't realize it was the same stuff.
Ah.
And so a lot of the things that you see in Lech, you just see a less, not quite on steroids version of it in other caves in the Guads.
So the challenge is once you got into Lech. I mean, I've read Deep Secrets a couple of times. How much of that book did you write?
Well, there was three of us that were like originally like the main authors because we had been writing trip reports all along. We documented everything. And we invited Larry Fish to kind of take all of our trip reports and all of our writings and kind of put it together into the main story. And then, of course, it's like, well, whose name gets to be first? And I don't even remember how we figured that out, but we worked it out that everybody was happy. And to me, it was like, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that we put out a cool book.
It was a super cool book. I mean, worth reading twice. And so, like, from what I remember, the first big obstacle was the rift. Right. Like as far as like a big obstacle, obviously Boulder Falls was technical, not terribly, but then you get into the rift and you had to figure that out. I mean, how long did it take to get through that thing?
Well, so the first couple of trips after the breakthrough, it was quick survey. It was like, boom, the cave just, you know, there was no obstacle to anything until you got to the rift. And the rift is this amazing feature. You're going down cave passage, you know, la da 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 da, and then boom, you hit this big like crack, this big rift. And it's just perpendicular to the passage that you come in on. And it's like, whoa. And so there was a survey line in the rift, and pretty much at that time, that's all we knew. It's like and I don't remember how much cave had been surveyed at the time. But of course, politics happened.
Right.
We won't go into that, but we'll just say politics happened.
Read the book. Everything.
Yeah. And the book doesn't even have it all in there.
I'm sure.
Because we wanted to focus on the cave and not on the politics. But so basically the cave got shut down for about a year. And so the next, when the next trip, you know, got to go in and everybody sort of reconstituted, we had no idea if the cave was going to continue to go. We just knew that, well, we're in this big rift and it looks like there might be some leads up high, but we couldn't really tell. And keep in mind that we were caving with carbide at the time. And so with carbide, it's really hard to see anything, you know, more than like 40 feet above your head. And so the first trip that went in there was with some caver climbers, Colorado caver climber guys. And they pretty much went to an area that looks sort of promising. It's like, well, there might be something up there. And they pretty much climbed this gypsum coated wall with like sky hooks and good luck and who knows what else. And they got into the upper rift. And the upper rift was the key to opening up the whole rest of the cave. And so, that took one trip. That was like one trip. It was like, boom, there it is, upper rift.
Wow. So what's going on geologically with the rift? Like, why did it change so dramatically so suddenly there at, what was it, C-37 station?
Ooh, that's good to remember stations.
I know
all those stations, but I don't remember them all anymore just because I've surveyed so much, so many other caves. I don't know how to describe the rift. It's not, I don't know that you could say it's a fault, but there are other caves in the Bois that form on these big, like slanting, like fissures, rifts. Like Sentinel Cave has a rift like that. There's other caves that look similar. And so the thing with Lech is not so much this big feature, but it's the rock unit that it's in. And so the cave is formed in this Permian-aged reef, like a sponge reef, an algal reef.
Yeah.
And different parts of the reef are more permeable. Water can move through it easier than other parts of the reef. So basically, you know, you can have, like, you have big chambers that form in the massive parts of the reef. Where the reef is, like, kind of a little bit, like, shoreward of your reef, then you get like different kind of passage development. So it's all really about being in this big exhumed reef. That's what you're running around on the inside of a multi-million year old reef. And that's what the cave is.
Mm. So among the like well-known features of Lech Eyggia, were you on any of the teams that discovered those areas? I'm thinking of, you know, like Persian Gulf, or, you know, the Chandelier Ballroom or Deep Secrets. Can you put your name on I was the first one there?
I can put my name on the Chandelier Ballroom.
Really? Oh, my gosh. that must have blown your mind.
No, actually, it didn't.
No?
What blew my mind was, well, I have to tell you the story, right? So what blew my mind was my survey team, how they lost their mind, not because of the chandeliers. Keep in mind, we're still carbide, right?
Yeah.
And we were off on what we thought was a cleanup trip. And the way that trips worked in those days was that you had people coming in and out of the cave at all hours of the day and night. I mean, it was crazy. And you would literally pass people in the rift. Here's my survey notes. Go, you know, check this out. Honest to God, that's really how it was. It was crazy. But so a team had come back from that part of the cave and they said, yeah, there's a bunch of, you know, we surveyed blah, 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 but there's still a bunch of cleanup leads to do. And so I, you know, got a team together and it's like, let's go clean up some of these leads. And at least, and at the time I was in like cartography mode. It's like, we need to survey as we go and finish things, not just like randomly run around and not, you know, survey things. Not that we weren't surveying things, but in the name of trying to be complete in what you did and thorough. And so I organized a survey team to, and that would have been Warren Anderson, Terry Bulger, Chris Green, and myself. Basically, I recruited those guys because I knew that they would go anywhere. you had to be picky about your survey teams.
Sure.
Much those days. And so we decided we were going to go clean up these leads. Well, there was another competing survey team. We didn't know at the time that we were competing led by another guy, another lech caver named Steve Sims. And he'd already been into some really big, cool, mazy part of the cave, and he wanted to go there. And he wanted to go there first because he knew that there was a big cave. We didn't know. We're just like, yeah, we're going to go clean up random leads. And so we got into the cave before they did, not even thinking about that, but we got into the cave before they did. And while we were taking a break, we could hear like these footfalls, like somebody was like running down the passage. And we're like, what the heck is that? And sure enough, it's Steve Sims' survey team running down the passage to try to beat us to the big leads, which we didn't know about. And so since we didn't know about them, we let them pass, right? And so we randomly picked a lead to start surveying in, and it was in some little crawly thing, and it popped out into this big chamber. And of course, I think Terry and Warren were the first ones that popped out into that. And I could hear their voices, you know, echoing. And I'm like, cool, we're going to get to do something more interesting than Boneyard. And so I'm sketching, trying to catch up. And I finally catch up to them, and they're all standing around, and they're like, we have to stop surveying right now because look, the cave keeps going. And it did. It went to the end of this room and then through another little narrow place and then boomed open into what ultimately became the prickly ice cube room. And they were focused on that. They didn't even see the chandeliers because they were all in the dark because we were all with carbide, right? We couldn't even see that there are these big freaking things hanging off the ceiling. You could see something there, but what was more exciting was that lure of more virgin passage. And so, of course, I'm like, we can't scoop, you know, that's not acceptable. I said, but why don't you guys take 15 minutes and I'll sketch this room. And so they were gone and I started walking around the room and then realized it's like, oh my God, these things are pretty amazing. And at that time it occurred to me that, you know, these could be like the trademark of this cave because I've never seen anything like these before. And ultimately that's what happened. But anyway, so my team comes back and they're like, okay, we need to just play through this room and continue on. And I'm like, no, we need to survey this room first, do a perimeter survey. And I think Warren was like, well, just humor her and let's just do it. So we did. And they're like, oh my God, these things, these are awesome. Chandeliers, right? So we finish that and head into this other big, huge room again. And we're sitting at the bottom of this slope. We decided we're going to sit and have lunch. And we start to see these little specks of light that come out on a balcony that we couldn't even see at first because we're all on carbide, right? And this is Steve Sims's survey team had got into this big boneyard maze. And they're now overlooking this huge room with cavers at the bottom. So they were very disappointed. And so anyway, they eventually made their way down there. And they had, I think they surveyed more than we did. Like Ray Keeler was on that trip and he's like, ah, well, you know, we surveyed more footage than you did. And I'm like, well, you got the footage, but dude, we got the booty. Slipping back to the chandeliers and they were all like, oh. But anyway, Ray says, what do we name this room? This big room. And the reason it was called Prickly Ice Cube is because you have all these big, like big, thick, like glaciers of gypsum. And then since water was dripping from the ceiling, it made these big drain holes in it. And it looked like, you know, big ice cubes with little pointy edges to it. And Ray's like, I think we should call it the Prickly Ice Cube Room. And I'm like, that is the stupidest name I've ever heard in my life. And he says, well, whatever. And I'm like, well, I'll write it down, but we're going to change it. And of course, we never changed it. So beware of what you name things.
So you were like the first person to ever like appreciate the chandelier ballroom, the very first person. I mean, I know that's probably no big deal to you, but that is so huge to someone who, you know, I mean, a casual caver like myself who, you know, has a family and doesn't get a lot of time to do things. And then whenever I watch, you know, Planet Earth, I'm like, there it is. And here I am talking to the person who was the first one to ever see the thing. really see the thing.
Yeah. I don't know what to say about that. But it was pretty amazing. And it truly, you know, the chandeliers are kind of like the, I don't know, when you think of Lech, you think of the chandeliers.
Yeah.
There's so many other mind-blowing things in that cave.
Oh, of course.
That was the first mind-blowing thing. And so it kind of overrode everything else.
So when was the last time you were in Lech?
2017. I was on a camp trip.
Oh, so it wasn't that long ago. I was going to ask you like what you thought of the way things were being run now versus the way things have been run in the past. And I know it's been under a lot of different people's control. And like you said earlier, there are politics there. We don't have to get into it. But in your opinion, a lot of people value, how do you think it's going right now? Is there still a lot to find there or what?
Oh, hell yeah. We just, we tried to have a 150-mile celebration, but, you know, that got canceled.
Yeah. I was invited. I was honored, but.
We're going to reschedule it. We just don't exactly know when yet. Hopefully sometime in the fall. But the cave still has a lot of potential. In a lot of the areas, the western branch of the cave has seen, like, a lot of exploration because that has been the, quote, easiest part of the cave to get to. There has to be more stuff in the far east, but that's more challenging to get to. Mm. And so I still believe that there's a lot of cave to be found.
Yeah.
Truly. I mean, you know, there's no reason why the cave shouldn't keep going. And now that, you know, people are doing more bolt climbs. Well, now that you could see to the top of the bolt climb, now that, you know, everybody's electric, we couldn't see those before. Now you could see them. There's bolting technology has gotten better. Actually, I don't know if they let you take a drill into Lech or not. I don't remember.
I don't think they do. I mean, I talked to Derek Bristol. I don't think they do, to my recollection.
But so, you know, a lot of the recent discoveries have been made as a result of doing these amazing bolt climbs. So I think the cave still has, you know, there's still a lot there. It's just that the low-hanging fruit, as in any caving area or any cave, that's usually what goes first. And then afterwards, of course, it takes more effort. But if you're willing to put the effort in it, the reward is there.
So you moved to Texas, or you're in Texas at this time. You're doing the Lech thing. So where did you go next? We're tracking you across the country.
Oh, my God.
So was TAG next?
Yes.
Okay.
I moved to Atlanta, although I still kept going to Lech. As a matter of fact, one of the coolest things about the whole Lech exploration was that it attracted cavers from all over the U.S. and from all over the world, too. And so you got to cave with people, well, who you normally wouldn't cave with because you didn't live in the same cave area. So you got to meet people from, you know, from Virginia or people from California. And so it was just this really, you know, cool experience in terms of people that you're caving with. And you made a lot of connections that way that for me, it's like people that I knew in Lech, well, let's go to Mexico. You know, it kind of like gave you, it was this massive networking thing that opened up a whole lot of other caving possibilities and opportunities if you're into project caving and expedition caving. But so I did move to Atlanta. Well, actually, I moved to Decatur, Georgia, which is a little town right outside of Atlanta, but still continued to go to Lech. And there was a pretty good contingent of TAG cavers who also, you know, continued exploration in Lech. And so, you know, that has never stopped.
And we talked a little bit about your Georgia years, the TAG years. So then you've lived in Kentucky now for a while, right? How long? Was Kentucky the next stop after Atlanta area?
Well, no, I ended up in Northern Illinois for a little while, and then I came back to Kentucky.
Yeah.
I've been to Kentucky since like 2001. But, you know, keep in mind in this U.S. caving odyssey that in addition to like going to Lech and, you know, caving in TAG, that I was also doing a whole lot of international caving as well.
Yeah.
Basically, I caved all the time.
The dream.
A ridiculously unbalanced life of caving all the time. And so either, you know, I caved every weekend. And if I didn't cave on a weekend, it was because we were in some foreign country caving. And so I did a lot of caving in Mexico, did a bunch of caving in China. Those were, like, strangely enough, the two areas that, you know, I did a lot of caving to in conjunction with caving in Lech and caving in the Quads and caving in Tech.
In Mexico, what were you doing? Were you doing Huautla? Were you doing Cheve? The big projects? Were you doing other stuff?
Well, I did Cheve. I only went on one, at that time, one Huautla trip, and that was in 1994. And that's when it was a Bill Stone trip when they were diving the sumps. And so I was basically a Sherpa, but I wanted to see Huautla. The thing, when I first started caving, okay, my grotto had, you know, as all grottos do, we had a grotto library. And I found all these things called AMCS newsletters in our grotto library. And I started reading those things. And it's like, and Huautla played really prominent in a lot of the 80s in the AMCS newsletters. And so this was like my dream place. I'm like, oh my God, I want to go there. And so I had to go there. And so that's why, you know, when I had an opportunity, I went to Huautla and saw some of those places that I had been reading about, you know, that I'd read about when I first started reading about it in the late 70s and early 80s. And so that was really cool. And then, you know, I went caving with, like, it was, to me, it was like caving with your idols. You know, it's like, oh my God, these people, they're Huautla cavers, and we go caving together in Lech or in Tag or whatever. So, yeah. And so I got involved with Cheve. I did some stuff in a bunch of stuff in Chiapas. I got involved with some of the Purificacion stuff. The most recent stuff that I got involved in Mexico was going to the Yucatan and basically, you know, kind of being around to break open this other big, amazing caving area, which the cave divers have always known that the Yucatan was amazing. But we always thought that all the caves were underwater and they're not. But anyway, that's a different story. So that's basically what I've done in Mexico. I've probably been on 30 some expeditions to Mexico.
Wow. Have you ever done any of that though, by the way, cave diving?
No, I never have. I know a lot of cave divers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you, that's a whole other different rabbit hole though. I mean, and for a lot of reasons, would you, I mean, have you ever thought about it?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
So on one of the first geology field trips that I went on as a grad student, we went to Florida. And it, up until that time, I was like, oh, cave diving is so dangerous. I would never even think about it. And so we were snorkeling over some of these big springs. And basically, you can look down and see this mondo huge cave entrance, but you can't get to it because you're not a cave diver. And so I was like, oh, man, if I lived in Florida, I'd have to be a cave diver.
Yeah.
And so maybe I will try it one of these days. I mean, I think it's a great exploration tool, especially if someone else is doing it. I can, like, hey, right. Some of the new exploration in Mammoth Cave has been via cave diving.
Wow. Yeah.
So
that's a lot of gear hauling though. I mean,
it's a lot of gear hauling.
What'd you do in China?
Well, you know, the first time I went to China was like in 1990, and it was with Michael Ray Taylor. I don't know if you know Mike Taylor. He's a writer and a caver, of course. And he got some gig with, I'm trying to remember the name of the magazine. It was some big name magazine. I don't remember the name of it. But anyway, they paid for this expedition to go to China, and somehow I got invited, which was cool. And so at the time, it was like, this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience to go to China, especially to go on an all expense paid trip to China. And so we went to a place called Guizhou Province, where there was just some obscenely big cave passages and big cave entrances. And we spent, you know, almost a month, maybe it was, I don't know, several weeks mapping this big Mondo cave all over the place. And our Chinese hosts were like telling us, oh, these caves have never been visited before. But we kept finding this funny little thread in the cave, which we didn't know at the time what that was. But that's Topofil. The French cavers had been all over the place. And the Chinese had just said, oh, yeah, this is, no one's ever been here before. So I'm sure that we remapped a lot of things that French cavers did, but we didn't know them and they don't know us. So, you know, it didn't matter. But anyway, so that was going to be my once in a lifetime caving experience in China, except that about 2 years later, a guy, a CRF caver named Chuck Peace, and Chuck has recently passed, unfortunately, but at the time he had retired from the military and he had a bunch of money to burn for whatever reason. And he's like, I want to take an expedition to China. And so he ended up, it was a CRF expedition, 12 people, all expense paid trip, yet a second trip to China. So here's my second, you know, in a lifetime experience to go to China. And we went, we went all over the place, mapped a whole bunch of cave. I can't even remember all the cave that we mapped, but it is in South Central China mostly. And then with my job, when I went to Western, after I graduated, I started working for my advisor, who is Dr. Chris Groves, and he got funding. Somehow he got some appropriation to do research in China. So I had like another 7 all expense paid trips to China. So that's how I got involved in that.
Yeah. And so
it's kind of like ridiculous. The stars lined up or something. I don't
know. Any highlights from like things that you found in China that were pretty significant?
There was a lot. And the thing is that I truly don't know if some of the things that we found had never been found before, or if once again, we were being led to places that, you know, other people had already been.
That doesn't downplay the significance of it.
Oh, no. I mean, it was like, basically what we know is that all over South Central China is a big, humongous cave area. And the cave passages there are like immense, like they're, I don't know how else to describe them. They were immense. And of course, the reason why I think they're so big is because China is like on the far eastern edge of a big plateau that includes the Himalaya Mountains, which are being actively uplifted. So I think what's happening is you have a lot of rain and you have big, thick sections of limestone and you have uplift going on and you just form like massive cave. And the limestone is really thick and totally amenable to forming a lot of cave. Aaron Lynch who now works at Carlsbad Caverns, has lived in China for a number of years. And she's done some amazing stuff in China. If you haven't talked to Aaron, you should.
Oh, all right. She's on the list.
Put her name on your list.
So Kentucky since the early 2000s, obviously Mammoth. What have you done there? There's still a lot being done.
In Mammoth?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Mammoth keeps growing a little bit every month, usually through Roppel Cave.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we have 2,000 feet that we can't tag officially on it yet because that's from a diving expedition. But, you know, every time you go into Mammoth, you break another record. It's making it even longer, even longer, longest cave. I haven't spent as much time in Mammoth as maybe like you think. I've been involved in like Hidden River Cave, which is another big cave system, not very far from Mammoth Cave. And Wigpistle Cave, which is a nice 35-mile long cave system that's, you know, it ought to connect to Mammoth. It's connected water-wise. We've tried to find ways to make that connection. I do have a cartography project in Mammoth, and I picked an area called Joppa Ridge. And Joppa Ridge is, it doesn't have a lot of cave in it, or at least it didn't have a lot of cave in it. It should have had more. And so I just undertook this big resurvey project because sometimes the best way to check out the leads is to resurvey. And, you know, we're trying to see if we could find a way to get to Wigpistle Cave. And so far we haven't found that way yet. So, but the thing is that even despite, you know, cavers working at Mammoth Cave for 60 years, that place is not caved out. There's still secrets. There's still ridges that ought to have cave in them that don't, not because it's not there, but it's because we haven't found a way into them yet. And so.
Well, and there are other things at work too, right? I mean, and we don't have to get real far into this, but I am curious what you think of the politics of Mammoth exploration over the decades. I mean, there are some people who, you know, would only allow certain groups and, you know, I mean, you're a little closer to it than I am, but I've heard the stories. I mean, I don't know. Do you have any comment on that whatsoever that you'd feel comfortable sharing?
Sure. So the first time I went to the Mammoth Cave area was in 1975, and I was a pretty brand new caver. And I heard about this group called the Cave Research Foundation. And, you know, as new cavers, you're always like, oh, I'd really wish I could go caving with those guys, but you have to get invited. And, you know, I want to go, I don't know. And so as it turned out, you did have to at one time be invited to participate in Cave Research Foundation. Ultimately, over the years, that has changed. But there was a time, and it totally coincided with when lots of big discoveries, new discoveries were being made at Mammoth, that people were being exclusive and kind of proprietary. And there was some cave wars going on between different groups working in, you know, not just in Mammoth, but in other area caves. And I think pretty much you can attribute it to testosterone. There was testosterone and ego. And what's happened that's changed is that everybody's grown up, so that a lot of the same cavers are still caving in the area, but now it's 30 years later. And so things are a lot more mellow than they were, you know, when like people were, you know, making secret trips into the Hawkins River and who knows, there was all sorts of crazy things going on. And all of that has mellowed out a lot because cavers have mellowed out. We're older. I hate to admit that. And so you kind of change your attitude about, you know, what's important and, you know, what you're doing and who you're doing it with. And so the individual groups have all gotten to make major discoveries. And so now it's a lot easier for everybody to work together because there's not so much ego at stake. Which is not to say that, you know, that's gone away from caving. It's not. But it depends on the maturity of the exploration effort. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's really promising to hear because, you know, I've heard from some people that it almost just seems like at one time, maybe it seemed like it was a lost cause to try to, you know, figure it all out and get it all calmed down to where, you know, we could just focus on what we need to do. And that's explore the Dagon Cave. I want to know what you think of the big picture of the caving world in the United States, the NSS and, you know, declining membership and things like that. We have a lot of young people that still come to grotto meetings at our grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto, and our neighbor grotto, the Bloomington Grotto. They've got a lot of young people involved as well. So I feel like we might be an exception, but all I ever keep hearing is there's not enough young people, not enough young people, got to get more young people. What do you think of that? And what are some of the other problems do you think we need to figure out?
Well, what year was the Pennsylvania convention? I don't remember what year, the most recent one. Was that in 2013?
Oh, gosh. I don't know.
I think it was. So basically, there was a huge U.S. presence in Czech Republic that year. Mm. And then not very long after that was the NSS convention. And so a lot of people who normally go to NSS conventions didn't go. I went because, well, I mean, I work in academia, so I have a lot of flexibility in my time. And the convention looked pretty old. You know, it's like, oh, my God. But it's not like the NSS is doomed and they're all old and, you know, whatever. It's just that all the people that normally would have gone didn't go. And those were a lot of the younger folks because they don't have as much time or as much money to go to everything that's happening in the summer. And they blew their wad in Czech Republic. But there are a lot of, there's still young cavers out there. They're doing stuff. It's just that they might not be doing things in the same scenario that, you know, you're used to in terms of a grotto. I think that the NSS itself as a big umbrella organization can't really do very much about trying to get more young people involved. The key to that has to be the grottos. It's the grottos. That's where they come in. That's where you develop like relationships with people. That's where you learn how to go caving. Like when I started caving, it was like I felt like I was in this training experience where, you know, your more seasoned members would be like, well, let me show you how your carbide lamp works and let's work on vertical. And there's all these people there who could train you to do stuff so that you could go caving. And so that, you know, at one time I was the young person getting this training and these experiences. And so now I'm like one of the people that want to share everything I know with younger cavers. They want to know how to survey. They want to know how to sketch. They want to know how to do all that stuff. And the way that they learn how to do that is through the grottos or through maybe like regions too. But so I don't think it's like a lost cause. I think that if the NSS wants to focus on something, quit trying to do it as a national organization and really support in some way. And there are ways to do it. Your grottos so that they could be the place where people come and learn, you know, the ethics of caving, the etiquette of caving, learning the skills. And, you know, it's about having a mindset too. And you learn that from the people that you cave with. You know, you learn about cave conservation. You learn about, you know, what is good ethics for, you know, caving in general. You learn that from people in your grotto. And grottos, as you know, they have newbies, they have people that have been around for frickin' ever, and they're all kind of like together. And I think that's where you're gonna, you know, that's where the saving grace is gonna be, is if you strengthen the grottos and keep the grottos going. That's what needs to be.
One last question. How often do you go caving for fun?
All my caving.
I mean, fun. I know it's all fun, come on, but how often do you go with no exploration agenda or something like that, and you just like, all right, we're gonna go here, and it's just gonna be a good day. I'm not bringing a book. I'm not bringing a Cinto. I'm just bringing my light.
Well, I have to tell you, I have a split agenda. Okay.
And okay.
Of course, obviously, exploration and survey is a very strong, you know, agenda.
Sure.
The other part of the agenda is basically trying to understand caves and karst and how they form and different parts of caving. And so if I'm doing one of those two things always, I don't have a time where I'm just randomly, let's just go in a cave. So, you know, it's like, I can't go into a cave for no reason.
Well, of course.
I don't know how to explain that. It's like to just do it as purely, I know what you're saying is to do it as purely a recreational experience where you want to challenge yourself or you just want to go to a place that you've never been before. So I have to have an agenda. I always have to have an agenda. I don't ever go without one. And it's either exploration survey or science, which all to me are like, it sounds all serious, but I am always having a fabulous time when I'm surveying. Or so I think it's even unfair to ask that question, because just because somebody doesn't like to survey doesn't mean that what they're doing is not important and they shouldn't do it. Because, you know, yeah, I'm a hardcore mapper, but I do it because not because I'm duty bound, but because I love to do it. If somebody loves to challenge themselves, as long as, you know, as long as you're not negatively impacting the cave and whatever you do, you should be able to do whatever. You don't want to survey, fine. You don't want to do science, fine. Those are not requirements. As long as you always are keeping the the best interests of the cave in mind, then you should be able to do whatever you want. Photography, you know, all there's so many different things. If there weren't so many different avenues that you could take for caving, I don't know that I would be doing it this long. Because my mindset when I first started, or maybe when I've been caving for 10 years or whatever, is completely different, and it's evolved over time, and I've taken different interests. And that's why caving is so cool, because you can go in so many different directions. Because you're not going to do the same thing for friggin' 45 years over and over and over again. You know, you just aren't. Like, if you do it as often as, like, some people do it. So.
Is there anything else you want to bring up before we close out?
Well, I guess, and I don't know if I've specifically said this before, but even though, you know, caving as we know it, and I'll call it in its modern sense in the U.S., even though we've been doing this for like 60 years, that we are still in the golden age of caving.
Yeah.
This place is not caved out. Look at Jewel Cave. They just made Jewel Cave 200 miles. You have any doubt that there'll be another 100? I don't doubt it at all. You know, there's so many places that, yeah, a lot of cave has been found, but there's a lot of places where there should be cave and it's not been found yet. There's places all over the world that, you know, were at one time too remote to go to that we can go to now. So, you know, now it's like we are, and we will be for a long time, in the golden age of caving. There's still a lot to do. There's still a lot to find. There's enough to go around for everybody, believe it or not. And so that's my big statement.
There you go. All right. Well, Pat, when I first started this thing, 4 years ago now, I made a little list of like dream guests, as I said at the top of the show, and you were on it. And so thanks for making dreams come true, Pat.
Why, you're welcome.
And thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for doing it. It's great. It's a great idea.
Oh, Pat, you really did. You really did. You made dreams come true. It was so much fun to go back and listen to that again and edit it, you know, because it, like I said, I've been waiting and waiting to talk to her, and I'm so glad that it went so well. She was so open with me, and I felt like I was in the presence of caving greatness, and she couldn't have been cooler about it, you know. I'm so happy that we got to talk, and I am so excited for next month's guest. Are you ready for this? You're ready for this. Bill Stone. Okay. If you know Bill Stone, you're excited. If you don't, you should be, and you should know him. Okay. He has led so many expeditions, especially down in Mexico. He's known for his exploration of Cueva Cheve, he also is known in the aerospace community for developing technology, which could end up and has ended up in space and doing important things. And my gosh, we talk about that. I cannot wait for you to hear the conversation. Well, it's not really a conversation, if I'm being completely honest. The podcast with Bill Stone coming on August 1st. I kind of just said, hey, we're here with Bill Stone. And then he talked for over an hour. And if you know Bill, maybe you're not surprised. I don't know. But I got a lot out of him, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Support this podcast by supporting caving. Make donations to your local grotto, your local karst conservancy, and our sponsors too, of course, elspelio.com. You don't have to make a donation. You can just buy a product, buy a headlamp. The Terra is still $50 off, or save $20 off all regularly priced headlamps with the promo code podcast at elspelio.com. You can support our past sponsors, Swago at swagogear.com. Get the Swago packs, or Organic Robot on Etsy. Great caving related apparel. Go to the Etsy store, Organic Robot, all one word. What am I missing? Probably not much. I won't waste any more of your time. Until next time, kill nothing but time.